Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington. Today is Tuesday, March 28th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Vice President Harris pledges security assistance and partnership during Ghana visit.
To help address the threats of violent extremism and instability, today I am pleased to announce $100 million in support of Benin, Ghana, Guinea, Cote d'Ivoire, and Togo.
Sudanese civilian and military leaders begin discussions on security reforms. Guinea's military government denies human rights violations. Liberian citizens react to their country's standing in the U.S. human rights report. Some 50 opposition members of Zambia's parliament want to protest this week's democracy summit in their country. Nearly 600 former Boko Haram militants graduate from rehabilitation. Uganda opposition wants proportional representation in parliament ahead of 2026 elections. Libyan state and armed groups allegedly commit war crimes with impunity.
So those coming from East Africa, for example, attract a higher price in terms of smuggling and trafficking than those coming from West Africa.
And two Zimbabwean women emerged as pillars of hope for struggling migrants in South Africa. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Vice President Kamala Harris pledged more than $100 million in U.S. assistance in Ghana and stressed that U.S. interests in African nations extend beyond competing with China on the first full day of a week-long tour of the continent. VOA's Anita Powell is traveling with the vice president and reports from the Ghanaian capital, Accra.
Vice President Kamala Harris said Monday that the U.S. will commit more than $139 million in assistance to Africa, most of which will support conflict prevention in the Sahel region, where Islamist extremists have expanded their footprint. She spoke Monday at Jubilee House, the seat of Ghana's presidency, alongside Ghanaian President Nana Akufo-Addo.
To help address the threats of violent extremism and instability, today I am pleased to announce $100 million in support of Benin, Ghana, Guinea, Cote d'Ivoire, and Togo. Last week, President Joe Biden announced a strategic plan for coastal West Africa as part of the United States strategy to prevent conflict and promote stability. Today, funding and the announcement that I've just made will help implement that plan and will address security, governance, and development issues in the region.
Harris is the fifth high-ranking U.S. official to visit the continent this year, and she deflected criticism that the U.S. sees African nations through the lens of its own competition with China, which has built massive infrastructure projects and loaned billions of dollars to African nations in what many see as a fight for influence and access.
The president and I had a conversation on this very topic, but the conversation was not about China as much as it is about the enduring and important direct relationship that the United States has with Ghana and with African nations. I will tell you that we are very clear, and I will speak for myself and on behalf of the Biden-Harris administration, that the relationship between the United States and this continent and African leaders is an important one. There's a historical basis for the relationship. Not to mention, as we look forward, as all governments should, and recognize the unachieved, as of yet, opportunities that exist going forward.
Akufo-Addo agreed.
There may be an obsession in America about Chinese activities on the continent, but there's no such obsession here. But China is one of the many countries with whom Ghana is engaged in the world. Your country is one of them. Virtually all the countries of the world are friends of Ghana, and we have relations in varying degrees of intensity with all of them. Our relationship with America is a relationship that has been forged over several decades, right from the time of independence and up till now.
Toured some of Accra's vibrant art scene, visiting a skateboard park and recording studio. Tagging along for the ride was actor Idris Elba, who spoke to journalists.
I think it's a great significant signal for a VP to come to Ghana, to come to Africa, and and be that interfacing, you know, to show the rest of the world that actually it's a fantastic place to sort of look at in terms of partnership and investment.
Harris plans to spend another full day in the West African nation before continuing east to Tanzania and then south to Zambia. Anita Powell, VOA News, Accra.
United Nations investigators accused Libyan state security forces and armed militia groups of committing an array of crimes with impunity, many of which could amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity. The report will be submitted to the UN Human Rights Council this week. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The three-member UN independent fact-finding mission on Libya has just presented its final report on the human rights situation in that country since the beginning of 2016, and the picture is not pretty. The United Nations investigation documented cases of arbitrary detention, murder, rape, enslavement, extrajudicial killing, and enforced disappearance. Despite the gravity of these crimes, the investigators say nearly all the survivors interviewed did not lodge official complaints out of fear of reprisals. The chair of the Libya fact-finding mission, Mohamed Ojar, says the team found overwhelming evidence that migrants have been tortured while in detention and that sexual slavery, a crime against humanity, was committed against migrants. He speaks through an interpreter.
The violations and abuses investigated by the mission were connected primarily to the consolidation of power and wealth by militias and other state-affiliated groups. It is beyond question that significant revenue arising from the wide-scale exploitation of vulnerable, irregular migrants incentivized the continuation of the violations documented.
The mission has made 13 field trips to Libya since the UN Human Rights Council established it in 2020. It interviewed more than 400 survivors and witnesses and collected more than 2,800 items of information. The report says more than 670,000 migrants from over 41 countries were in Libya when the investigation began, and the number has increased since 2021. Many of the migrants, who include asylum seekers and refugees, come from Africa and lands as far away as Afghanistan. Mission member Chaloka Bayani says smuggling and trafficking of migrants has become a huge money-making industry in Libya. He says geography largely determines which migrants are likely to be kidnapped and held for ransom.
So those coming from East Africa, for example, attract a higher price in terms of smuggling and trafficking than those coming from West Africa. The perception is that perhaps they have a lot more money in this regard.
The mission calls for the immediate release of all those arbitrarily detained in Libya and for secret prisons to be dismantled. It says perpetrators of gross human rights violations must be held accountable for their crimes. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The opposition in Uganda's parliament says the country needs to adopt a proportional representation system in choosing the members of the legislature. Matthias Mpuuga says the current winner-takes-it-all system does not reflect the will of the electorate and entrenches unpopular leaders. Uganda's next general election is in 2026. Mpuuga explains to me the bill that the opposition plans to introduce for parliament to bring about constitutional and electoral reforms.
We are still calling across the opposition spectrum and civil society, together with other stakeholders, culture leaders, and community leaders, about the key constitutional and electoral reforms that we believe we can engender as the opposition to try and reproject the country on a new electoral acceptable democracy that is more sustainable. Given the nature of our polarizing politics, or winner takes all in a multi-political, multicultural, multi-ethnic society, we're trying to evolve a framework that will be more inclusive, that will be more involving and more representative of the people than the winner takes all first past the post that we have.
So, Honorable, how would proportional representation work, and how is it different from the current system that you have?
Under the strict rules of proportional representation, the constituencies so cut out must, as of necessity and practice, have more or less the same population. Constituencies are carved out of equal numbers of people, and that must be entrenched in the constitution through a population quota that will facilitate the making of the constituents, not the current gerrymandering. The gerrymandering that we have today is that constituencies are cut out at the pleasing and the pleasure of the powers that be. Secondly, it will allow for the entrenchment of multiparty democracy, because under proportional representation, you nominate a presidential candidate and the percentage of votes they get across the country will be the same percentage of representation in the parliament. I'll give you an example. The National Inter-Platform candidate, the Honorable Robert Chagrin Bobi Wine, in the last election was deemed to have gotten 36% of the national vote, but he has less than 15% of members of parliament, meaning that the members of parliament NUP has in parliament does not reflect the will of the people of Uganda in parliament. So the percentage of national votes you get will equal to the members of parliament you get. That's proportional representation.
What are the chances that such a bill to amend the constitution would succeed or would pass?
Certainly, I cannot give you the percentage of chances, but it's part of the national conversation that we believe is late. The current system is polarized. The system is tired. The system is without vents. We need to free the current group from their own captivity, that our conversation must herald a variety of issues, including the nature of government. For example, in the proposition, we also intend to have a new conversation about the nature of power devolution, not the current decentralization, which has since been centralized. So we're going to have a wide-ranging conversation with stakeholders, and that should come with potent pressure, enough pressure, to make the system yield that this probably could be the breakthrough they desired to even free themselves of their own captivity, which is centralization and polarization, which is they have entrenched.
Honorable Mpuuga, it's a pleasure speaking with you, and thank you very much.
Much humbled, James.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, March 28. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Sudanese civilian and military leaders kicked off a conference in Khartoum on Sunday to discuss strategy for integrating all armed groups into one unified army. Military leader Abdul Fattah al-Burhan reiterated the military's commitment for security reform, including reintegrating armed forces into one army, saying it's key to realizing true democracy in Sudan. Michael Atit reports for VOA from Khartoum.
During the three-day conference, military and civilian officials are talking about the thorny issues of forming a national army and the integration of the paramilitary forces and all former rebel groups into one army. Unifying the army is one of the framework political agreements signed between the military forces and civilian leaders in December last year. Addressing the participants at Friendship Hall in Khartoum on Sunday, General al-Burhan reiterated the military's commitment to pursue a unified army under civilian rule and warned against politicizing the process.
We would like to build an army that is committed to the standards that are practiced in every democratic system.
Al-Burhan orchestrated a military coup in October 2021. Since then, pro-democracy groups have led protests against the military rulers and demanded that the military hand over power to civilians. Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, deputy head of the Sovereign Council, who heads the Paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, reiterated his commitment to the civilian leadership and the reintegration of the RSF during the transitional period at the opening of the conference.
We have accepted the reintegration process with full awareness. We have benefited from the humanitarian experiences within our African region and the world at large. There are similar reintegration processes that have occurred around us, even though their situations are different from the Sudanese reality.
Conference participants are expected to come up with a time frame for reintegration of all armed groups into one army per the Juba peace agreement. Khalid Omar Youssef, a spokesperson for the ongoing political process, stressed the need for all Sudanese to engage in a peace process.
We are meeting here as Sudanese who have our common interest for the future of our country. This shows our joint keenness to protect our country and shows our continued efforts to place it back in its original and worthy position.
Those attending the conference are signatories to the framework agreement, including regular forces, armed groups, and specialists. Volker Perthes, who heads the United Nations mission in Sudan, stresses the importance of reaching a common understanding that includes military, intelligence, and police reforms, along with integration and security arrangements. Michael Atit for VOA News, Khartoum.
In Zambia, about 50 opposition members of parliament are planning to organize demonstrations to protest the coming two-day democracy summit scheduled from Wednesday, March 29 to March 30 in the capital, Lusaka. Speaking in parliament, the leader of the opposition legislators, Brian Mudubile, says the 50 lawmakers are displeased by Western nations' plan to promote LGBTQ issues in Zambia, using the summit as a pretext. For more on the plan, VOA's Peter Clotte reached Brian Mudubile in the Zambian capital, Lusaka.
This particular function was to be co-hosted by other countries like Costa Rica, the Netherlands, South Korea, Zambia, the U.S., among others. These are countries that have been promoting LGBTQ rights. So the members of parliament were drawing examples from recent events that have happened in the region, where a conference is held under the title of Democracy Summit and so on. But when the details of the actual conference are unveiled, it's discovered that it has something to do with the promotion of LGBT rights. Secondly, the holding of the summit on democracy has been shrouded in secrecy. There's been no ministerial statement on the floor of the House up to now, you know, to inform members of parliament what this particular summit is all about. And again, members of parliament feel there may be something more to these conferences, to this conference and the visit that meets the eye.
But Honorable Mundubile, why wouldn't you wait for such things to crop up and see what the president's reaction will be before embarking on such protests? Some people are of the view that this process is just to undermine what his government is trying to do by making him unpopular in the sight of the international community.
Yes, Peter, if you listen to me very carefully, I informed the House that members of parliament are threatening to stage protests, okay? The stage at which those protests should be staged was not stated on the floor of the House. So many people have gone to draw conclusions that those protests will actually be staged before the conference. But what I informed the House was that members of parliament were planning to stage protests. And all that was needed was information regarding the issues that are raised.
Some people are suggesting that the planned or threatening to embark on a protest is just a mere publicity stunt just to make the opposition feel relevant in such matters. How do you respond to that?
Not at all. This matter is very, very serious indeed, Peter. But you know, we are a very, we are an opposition political party that is responsible. We have informed our friends in government time and again that we will not behave like they did whilst in opposition. We are not destructive. We've been very civil, we've been very structured even in this particular case. So what we did, we put our case forth on the floor of the House. And when we did our media interaction later in the day, we also put our case forth. We are just waiting to hear from government. We want to hear from government what the position is before any action can be taken. So we're very responsible in the manner that we're handling this particular matter.
Brian Mudubile is the leader of Zambia's opposition in parliament. He was speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty. Nigerian authorities say a rehabilitation program for former Boko Haram sect fighters is helping weaken the group's fighting power. Nearly 600 fighters graduated from the program over the weekend and tender a public apology for their actions. Authorities say they will be reintegrated into society, but experts are warning of possible relapse, as Timothy Obiesu reports from Abuja.
Who will be the good ambassadors of this very facility?
Some 590 former Boko Haram fighters dressed in white simultaneously echoed an oath of allegiance to Nigeria during a graduation ceremony Saturday at the De-Radicalization, Rehabilitation and Reintegration DRR camp in northern Gombe State. They are the latest batch of voluntary defectors from the sect to undergo the six-month physical, mental, and psychosocial rehabilitation program tagged Operation Safe Corridor. Nigerian authorities started the Safe Exit program in July 2016 as a strategy to degrade the fighting power of terror groups like Boko Haram. Program coordinator Uche Nnabuihe spoke to Lagos-based television during the ceremony.
Based on the therapeutic interventions this set of clients have undergone, they are better citizens from when they initially arrived the DRR camp and accordingly, sir, are certified fit for graduation and subsequent reintegration to their respective communities.
Authorities said three of the graduates are from Niger and one from Chad, while the rest are Nigerians, mostly from Borno, Adamawa, Yobe, Zamfara, Niger, and Nasarawa states. The former fighters offered a public apology and promised to embrace peace in their respective communities. Security analyst Senator Irebu says the program could help in theory, but warns there could be relapses.
Repentance or whatever is in the things of the is a thing of the mind. Someone can pretend, you know, to pretend to have repented because the condition to express himself otherwise is not there. This is a controversial program in many facets, so there will always be resistance to it. What are the, have been the impact? Has it been able to stop more recruitment?
Authorities say thousands of repentant Boko Haram members have been freed since 2019 and that they have become productive members of society. But in 2021, Borno State Governor Babagana Zulum called for a review of the program, saying ex-Boko Haram members spy on communities and then rejoin the group. Local communities in Borno, which is the epicenter of Boko Haram insurgency, have also questioned the program. Vivian Belong, founder of Social Action Nigeria, explains why.
It appears that attention has only been rehabilitation attention has mostly been focused on the rebels themselves, whereas the communities also suffered very far-reaching trauma. So, and they are actually supposed to undergo psychological rehabilitation, psychosocial rehabilitation. And I have not seen this sufficiently being done for them.
Belong says it will not be easy for the former fighters to be accepted back into the communities they once harmed.
These are communities that have been abducted en masse. Their women have been raped. These are communities that their children, some of the children, have watched their parents being slaughtered, you know, by this. These kind of things have a way of having a lasting impact in the minds of the victims. So how do you expect them to forget?
Boko Haram has been fighting to create an Islamic caliphate in northern Nigeria since 2009. The violence has led to tens of thousands of deaths and spilled over into neighboring Niger, Chad, and Cameroon. On Sunday, Nigerian Defense Authority said some 51,000 Boko Haram militants and their families surrendered to Nigerian forces between July 2021 and May 2022. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
And that's it for this Tuesday, March 28th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your morning with us. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Barton in Washington, wishing you will have an amazing Tuesday.